You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
And it's a big hour here, Scott. Thank you very much. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Kelly Evans. Here's all what's ahead. Microsoft's Developers Conference underway with CEO Satya Nadella giving the keynote right now. We will continue to bring you all the headlines from that event as we get them, get some reaction as well. And the tech-heavy NASDAQ is just fractionally higher now after hitting another record high yesterday. We're on record close watch for the NASDAQ and the S&P, while the Dow is on pace for a second positive day in three. Quick check of the 10-year shows it just around the 440 level, even as we've heard from five Fed officials so far today, all conveying kind of the same message. The path down to 2% will be longer than expected, and it will be bumpy. Here's where that puts market probabilities right now. First cut expected to come in September. Let's see if that changes. After our live and exclusive interview, Steve Leisman is standing by with Fed Governor Chris Waller. Welcome to both of you. Steve?
Kelly, thanks very much. I am here in Washington with Fed Governor Chris Waller. Governor Waller, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Hey, by the way, I hear birthday wishes are in order.
Oh, thanks very much. That's not on the agenda here today. We've got a lot to talk about, but thank you very much. Can we dive right in and talk about the inflation dynamic as you see it? How was 2023 in terms of the what has been called really the solid progress that was made in inflation differed so far from 2024? And how does that dynamic going to work this year?
Yeah, so I would say 2023, the second half of the year, we really did see a lot of unwinding of supply side problems. We also saw a large surge in immigration that wasn't really appreciated until much later. And that did a lot of things. One, it had a very positive effect on growth, employment, but at the same time, prices were coming down, which would you typically would think would happen with a supply side. But the first quarter of this year and what we're staring at now kind of looks much more like demand side. So I've kind of argued in the past, a lot of supply side stuff, except for the immigration, is kind of unwound. And so what you're staring at now is much more demand. And that's where policy is going to have bite to kind of bring the economy back into more modern state and bring inflation back down to target.
So to the extent that you said this morning in your speech, you expect inflation progress to continue. Is it from the demand side and a weakening demand that you expect progress to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that is my view. Others may not, but that's my view that demand, the supply stuff is pretty much running its course. It's kind of hard to appeal to pandemic supply side problems. When every firm I talk to, they're like, no, supply side is not really the problem. So in that case, it really is demand. And in that sense, it's just, you know, strong consumer demand. They're basing that off of a very good jobs market. Their jobs are secure. Their real wages are rising. And that gives you confidence to consume, particularly in the middle and upper groups. Now, some of the lower groups, we're seeing a little more stress.
But you've seen some weakening overall in April, and that you think helped bring down the inflation numbers?
Well, the inflation numbers are kind of, you know, they're kind of middling around the 0.3 right. monthly numbers. That's why I was joking this morning. The second digit seems to be a big deal, whether it's above 0.3 or below 0.3. But I think it will. Whatever we saw happen, we're going to see policy start to put more downward pressure on demand. We're seeing it through the labor market. We're starting to see it in surveys of manufacturing, non-manufacturing, things I mentioned this morning. So I think keeping the policy rate where it is, it's restrictive, that'll continue to sort of slowly grind down the economy, but not throw it off a cliff.
Tell us how you measure restrictiveness in the policy rate.
Well, I'm going to do the standard thing, which is I'm going to take the policy rate, and then I'm going to take off, you know, expected inflation year out. And when you do that, and those are roughly around 2% or a little above, so you're staring at a real policy rate of 2.5% to 3%. And I think that's by most kind of estimates, restrictive stance. Now, if you think, you know, R star, the infamous R star is much higher.
The neutral rate.
Then you're probably saying, well, it's not tight enough. But I think it is. And I think we're starting to see the moderation throughout the economy.
So baseline seem to have shifted quite a bit in the market. They shifted for Federal Reserve officials. Does your baseline still call for rate cuts this year?
Well, I would say that the data is not looking like we need to raise rates. So, and like I said this morning, you never say never as a central banker, but I don't think we're going to need to raise rates. So that means either hold rates steady for longer, rate cuts get pushed out, and if the data were to continue softening throughout the next 3 to 5 months, you could even think about doing it at the end of this year.
So towards the end of the year. So not multiple cuts necessarily, maybe one or a few.
Depends on the data.
But it's got to be sort of consecutive, and it's got to show clear progress.
Yeah, we have to be confident. You know, we thought we kind of had it through the last 6 months of last year, and then once again, you kind of get surprised. So we just need to really make sure it's on its way down to target, and we think it'll stay there.
Do you think of rate cuts as a process, or is it possible to do one and hang out for a while, do another one? Or is it a process? And also, do you worry about the market sort of overdoing it if you start to cut rates?
Yeah, I think the idea you would say cut once and then sit for 6 months, I'm not really sure what you're trying to accomplish with that. So when you cut rates, it's because you think policy needs to be loosened or doesn't have to be as tight. And that typically doesn't one cut.
Right.
So it's usually you want to think about a sequence of cuts. Well, whether you want to do them three or four consecutive meetings, or go every other meeting, but the idea of just doing it once and then sitting there for 6 months just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
How do you measure the downside and the upside risk? Are they balanced right now, or do you have concern that if you hang around at this restrictive rate too long, that you create too much momentum to the downside that maybe you can't control?
That was what we were worried about the first 3 months. The first month, January, you're thinking maybe it's some weird seasonal things, but we saw it again in February, we saw it again in March. We finally started getting some evidence that the economy was moderating on the real side and that we got a break on inflation if we get some more. That's why I don't think there's a lot of upside risk. And like I said, things could change and rate hikes could be on the table under some scenarios in the world. But right now, I don't see that as the case. More likely we stay where we're at for months. And then if we get enough data going the right way, then we can think about cutting rates.
How do you think about federal spending? I know it's not something you like to comment about the level of, but it's something that you have to deal with. They're giving you those cards and you have to play them. Do you forecast the impulse from federal spending will decline this year, or is it still something that you think will be adding to growth in the quarters to come?
Well, I think the level of spending is probably not going to change that much, but that's not going to cause a lot of growth rate effects in the sense of accelerating growth. It may keep growth high, but it's not going to cause growth to go high. Yeah, I mean, there's just more. The bigger issue for me is just long-term, is deficit spending going to get to a point where treasury issuance outruns treasury demand and rates start going up? And that will affect us in terms of how we think about our star.
Does it factor into inflationary impulses that you think of? Is federal spending, you think, part of the inflation problem we have?
That I'm not really, I can't really say. There's a lot of like regional evidence, particularly with all the EV stuff, that there's a lot of surge in demand for various equipment stuff. But we'd have to, you know, it's a $28 trillion economy. So something like an extra $50 billion or $100 billion of fiscal spending really is going to do a whole lot to the whole economy. I think that's what gets lost a lot of times. It's a huge economy. To have a big effect on the economy, it's got to be really broad-based.
So from one topic you'd love to talk about to another, there's talk this week that there's agreement on the Basel III endgame proposal that would really reduce the burden of the capital increase to the biggest banks. Is that something you support?
Well, we had an open board meeting last summer where we publicly took our positions. And you could see from that meeting there was kind of tepid support altogether for that proposal.
For
the original proposal that went out. I dissented against sending it out. Governor Bowman sent it out. Other comments were very lukewarm on it. So
Governor Bowman dissented.
Yes.
Right.
So it should not be a surprise that to get something where we could all kind of roughly support, it was going to take some time. So I've kind of taken the view that on Basel, the same as monetary policy, there's no rush. We can do it, take our time, get it done right. We're not in any hurry to get it done just for the sake of getting it done. So that's kind of my view. And if we get to a point where we can all agree on it, then that's when it'll be appropriate to put it out.
But just to push you on, it's something that would reduce the overall level of the increase in capital from the original proposal. Is something that's more in line with your way of thinking?
Well, that's what I said at my dissent.
Yeah, right.
I thought particularly the operational risk impact on capital was just way out of whack. And that was over 50% of the capital increase.
There's an election coming up. The Federal Reserve is being talked about. by one side more than the other, but I'm wondering how much you think about the Federal Reserve independence and the need for that to be remain in place, and also when it comes to sort of the pushback, people say, hey, you guys talk too much.
Well, I mean, I've been studying central bank independence since I was in graduate school, was what my PhD thesis was written on. And, you know, the independence has served us well. It keeps us thinking long term. We don't take political sides trying to influence elections. But at the same time, I always try to stress that there's two aspects. We have independence in how we set our instrument, the Fed funds rate, to achieve our dual mandate. We are still accountable to Congress and the American people. And those are two aspects of it. We are free, given we are given our objectives, we use our tools to meet that objective, but we are accountable. And we do that through the chair's testimony, explaining in the press conference and the statement why we are doing things and what we do.
So I do CNBC.
That. Right here on CNBC. So central bank independence is critical. It's always been an important role to keep politics as much as possible out of the actual setting of the policy rate. It does show up in the form of who gets appointed to the Board of Governors, for example. Those are political appointments. That was some of my research 30 years ago, was this is kind of a way that the political preferences get put into place. It's not by somebody you dictate to, but they have the same preferences that you tend to have as an administration.
But I have a hard time saying that the appointees of Biden or Obama are more dovish right now than those from another president.
Right. In a sense, when you get in, you think about your dual mandate. That is your job. How do you make sure that you have full employment and price stability? That's what you is just our job, no matter who put us in.
Governor Waller, thanks for joining us. New part of your job right here on CNBC.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Appreciate it. Kelly, back to you in Jersey there.
And thanks for bringing that to us on your birthday, Steve. You know I was going to mention it again. We really appreciate it. Our Steve Leisman reporting.
Appreciate it. This was a good present. Thanks.
My next guest agrees that the Fed has no reason to cut now, but says that conversation will be alive and well if the unemployment rate rises above 4%, and we are oh so close. Let's bring in Peter Bukvar. He's Chief Investment Officer at Blakely Financial Group and a CNBC contributor. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Kelly.
Anything jump out to you from what you just heard in particular?
It's clearly a wait-and-see, play-by-ear mode that they're in. I think they're obviously leaning towards cutting. I think they want to take sort of the edge off the current level of the Fed funds rate. They're just looking for a reason to do so, and in their eyes, they haven't found it yet.
I think it's interesting that 10 years only at 440 as we talk about all this. Are you surprised the way markets have reacted? Because the Fed officials are clearly signaling, wait, we need to wait and see a little bit more now, kind of trying to push back that timeline.
Well, I think the markets are hoping that the momentum to cut will build as the year progresses, particularly the ECB is going to cut in June. The Bank of England seemingly wants to cut. Bank of Canada may do so again. So I think there is sort of a growing momentum that this is the thing to do and that the Fed will follow. But there's a lot of conflicting, complicating stories that are happening here. You have the unemployment rate that is at a 2.5-year high, even though on an absolute historical basis, it's still pretty low. But we see what's going on with commodity prices.
I was just going to ask.
I mean, can any self-respecting central banker want to cut rates when gold's at an all-time record high? If you perceive gold as money, now
we're going to debate gold bull bear a little bit later in the show. So what's your spin on that? Well, it's interesting to me to watch gold and copper both at all-time highs.
Aluminum at a 2-year high. The industrial raw material index from the CRB is at the highest level in a year. So it is somewhat broad-based, at least on the industrial metal side. Silver also joining the party here. Now, there's no doubt that central banks have been massive buyers of gold, but they're doing that for a reason. They're doing that because they don't want to own as many dollars via U.S. Treasuries. So the Fed needs to pay attention to the price of gold, because if they get too aggressive at some point with rate cuts, well, that's going to directly impact the dollar. If you start to weaken the dollar because of what you're doing with monetary policy, that can import inflation. You can see oil prices then rise. Then they're really kind of stuck. So there's no easy path here.
Does it tell you that markets, even though the Fed's trying to kind of push this timeline out, that markets basically are anticipating a dovish outcome? You know,
I think markets have been front running the easing of monetary policy for the last year plus.
That's generous, or forever, basically.
Yes,
yeah.
True.
No, but so what consequence does that tell you? Do they need to come out more aggressively against it and say, no, you're off to the race? Or does the market itself think the data is going to be more disinflationary in the back half? Because here's the last line from his, obviously, he also gave a speech this morning, and he referenced this, but he said, you know, what do I mean by good data? What grade do I need to give future inflation reports? Let's say I look forward to the day when I don't have to go out two or three decimal places in the monthly inflation data to find the good news. He wants it consistently below 0.3, basically.
Right. Well, you said a very important word, consistently, because the Fed right now is just trying to play the trajectory of inflation and saying it's coming our way. If we can just get a two handle on CPI, we're going to be okay to cut. But keeping it consistently low is sort of the next battle that is yet to be fought.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is it's weird to me that commodity prices seem to be telling us that they take the Fed at their word that it's all going to come down and these rate cuts are going to happen. You'd think that markets would push the other way and say, no way, it's not going to be as easy as you think. But if that were the case, wouldn't we see rates backing up and commodity prices selling off?
So I think the long end is believing that inflation will continue to moderate. The rise in commodity prices are saying, hey, not so fast. Hmm. This is a much more complicated situation than you think. It's not, okay, the economy slows, inflation just magically gets to 2%. The Fed cuts rates, we all declare victory and everything is okay. The commodity move here, I think, needs to be focused on, and as I said, is really going to muddy up the Fed's job here.
All right. Should we just abolish the Fed? Thomas Massie just reintroduced a bill to do so. It's about 3 pages long. He doesn't provide for what would take its place, but there seems to be no objective way of setting monetary policy. Do we need to move into a world where we're somehow looking for a market or a rule that will do so?
If you're a bank and I'm a bank, I think based on the supply and demand for money, we can create an overnight rate rather than 18 or 19 people sitting around a big table trying to price fix that cost.
You really think that if it's that easy, then why all of this hoopla? Why all of this drama?
We can only dream that the market would eventually at some point set the price of money.
Peter, we'll see. Thank you for joining me, Peter Buchvar, Bleakley Financial Group. Coming up, we'll go live to Seattle for Microsoft's latest AI announcements and where that leaves the tech giant in the AI arms race. Plus, like we were just talking about, gold is having a moment, hitting record highs, up 17% so far this year. Do you buy into the rally or is a pullback ahead? Our bull says there's more room to run. And the name to take advantage of it, we'll talk about this stock well positioned for gains from here. Our trader tells us why, and then we'll hear the other side. A classic bull bear debate is ahead. The Exchange is back in two.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Shares of Microsoft are hanging on to a percent gain right now as the company's developers conference continues with CEO Satya Nadella unveiling the latest AI announcement. Steve Kovac is live on the ground there. And Steve, what are the biggest takeaways so far?
Oh, Kelly, just a flood of AI announcements coming out of Microsoft Build. So let me go over a few of them. There are new features for AI Assistant Copilot, access to the latest technology from OpenAI, and a new partnership with one of the buzziest startups out there. Lots more, but mostly wonky developer stuff. But let's start with Copilot, new feature called Team Copilot. It works as an assistant for multiple people in a group or an entire company, takes meeting notes, keeps you on time in a meeting, reminds you of the most important topics, basically acts like a project manager. And then there's a test version of that coming later this year, but no word on how much it's going to cost. Also announcing some tools for companies to build their own custom copilots. That's something a lot of companies are already doing with other tools, basically because Microsoft's Copilot is too expensive for them. And then as for OpenAI, Microsoft is now offering access to GPT-4o. That's the new version OpenAI showed off last week. That's what lets you interact with ChatGPT over text, video, or audio, and chat naturally with the assistant. We got some demos of that as well. Microsoft also has its own AI model for those multimodal capabilities as well. But look, no sign of Scarlett Johansson here, but we are expecting to see Sam Altman take the stage any minute now. And a new partnership with Cognition, that's a really hot startup backed by Peter Thiel. It's only a couple months old and already has a $2 billion private valuation. It makes an assistant called Devin that does all the coding for you, not just a helper. Someone like you or me, Kelly, can basically tell it what you want it to make in a natural language, and the rest of the coding is automated. This is a real vote of confidence from Microsoft for such a young product and a young company. And of course, Microsoft gets a benefit there as well. Cognition's going to run all that activity on the Azure cloud, and more to come. This is a really long conference here, but so more demos and stuff coming soon, Kelly.
And look, a big buzzy startup in an age when people said AI wasn't going to lend itself to that. So it's just interesting to take that as a data point. Perhaps there will be more to come as well. Steve, boil this down for us. How do you think, you know, computing changes after today's announcements?
To be honest, not too much, because a lot of what was announced yesterday and what's being announced today is going to be rolling out kind of slowly. Those AI PCs, those Copilot PCs that were announced yesterday, those aren't going to go on sale until next month. And Microsoft says they don't expect to sell much more than 50 million of them this year. To put that in perspective, about 250 million PCs were sold last year, according to some third-party estimates. So, you know, you can just kind of game that out. Maybe one-fifth of PCs sold this year will have those AI capabilities. But, of course, it's coming to mobile apps and things like that. But, you know, in the near term, Kelly, you're still going to be using your stuff the way you've been using it.
And your smartphones and all the rest of it. Steve, thank you very much.
Exactly.
We appreciate it. We'll check back in soon. Steve Kovac. Microsoft has zero sells and 54 buy ratings on the street right now. My next guest among them, he's bullish and sees another 35% rally from here, helped by that Azure cloud growth. Here with his thoughts is Brent Thill. He's a software and internet research analyst at Jefferies, along with our very own Dheeraj Bosa. Welcome to both of you. Brent, what excites you, if anything, about the announcements of the last couple of days?
Thanks, Kelly. It's all incremental. Nothing really big splash. I think the opportunity for them to bring AI to the mass market in these new PC forms is really interesting, because if you think about today, we're in a CapEx wars with Microsoft, Amazon, and Google. But if they can put the processing power near us and not have to send it back to their cloud, we can incur the cost. So over time, there's a way that I think Microsoft's trying to figure out how to offload some of this AI processing cost. I think the other thing that's super impressive is that Microsoft's gaining mind share and market share among CIOs. They can talk AI from applications to infrastructure. And so I think at this point, we think they've gained the most market share. When we ask anyone in the industry, if you had to have a draft picked and you could pick one for AI and it's Microsoft, Amazon, or Google, 90% of the experts we talk to are drafting Microsoft. So I think the vision, they're ahead. They're thinking outside the box about even processing costs and where can they put this processing power locally. So we think this will be, again, all incremental out of the conference, nothing really big and new to get super excited about. It's pretty technical, but it builds into our thesis that they're so far ahead in this wave that we think that they can continue to drive close to $15 to $16 of earnings power. You put a 30 multiple on that, and the stock is firmly, you know, in the 500. So sure, we still think there's a lot of upside to go. And
yeah, absolutely. 550, I was going to say, is your price target. Dheeraj, and I was interested there, Brent. It was a different kind of discussion, but didn't mention Apple. And I just wonder if we need to wait and see what their competitive response is to trying to keep the iPhone and the voice assistant and Siri to be the stickiest relationship with the customer, even more so than, for instance, a new PC and a tool like that.
The last few weeks have been so event heavy, so announcement heavy. Even if they're incremental, they just raise the bar for Apple's WWDC, especially with this pretty impressive AI-powered PC. What is Apple going to do to kind of reclaim its spot and really tell investors that it has a strategy? Question for you, Brent. When did you take that survey asking people who they preferred in the AI race?
This is ongoing. We just had a call with another expert and many of our clients this morning on this. So this is as current as, you know, one big expert that reached out today. So
we continue to
hear there's a world of multi-cloud. So most enterprises are going to go multi-cloud. They're going to go Microsoft and Amazon, Google. They're going to take two. But when you ask, again, if you ask a simple question, is who is ahead? Everyone is saying Microsoft.
And so it's interesting when you say that, Brent, because you look at the stock price, and I think that over the last year it has been Microsoft, but would you say that you've seen a shift? You look at the stock price, Google's up 26% year to date versus a Microsoft up 14%. Do you think that there should be a shift, especially after I.O. last week when, you know, you talk about bringing AI to the masses, and who can do this better than Google turning on AI overviews for all of its search users by the end of the year?
Yeah, I think we bracketed enterprise versus consumer. And so we like Amazon and Microsoft in that enterprise world. For the consumer world, it's Meta and Google. And so to your point, why is Google had such a strong outperformance? Because they had such a slow start out of the gate in AI, and they've made up ground. And as we've said, there's more AI underneath the hood than they've been able to show. They've done a terrible job of explaining it. And so I think they're catching up. The stock's cheap at 12 times EBITDA. Wow. So yeah, I believe that Google is going to have a great seat at the table. When I talk about the survey work, that's for enterprise users. And that's where Microsoft is leading. I'd say Amazon's two and Google's a distant third.
Yeah. On that note, Brent, I'm curious if you could just dwell on this for a second. You said, and it's fascinating to think about, that Microsoft is actually trying to push people out of the cloud and back onto the into the puddle, or whatever we'd call the actual personal computer. But Azure is the excitement. You know, that the cloud is still why investors love this stock. Are you suggesting that it's not as good of a return on capital, or that margins are going to come under pressure because of the cost of all of this computing? I mean, it's interesting to say that their biggest strategic advantage is something they're actually trying to kind of push back against.
Yeah, they're not trying. This isn't going to have a dent in Azure. I think the long term basically is that you want us to have great experiences, right? So if you can put some of that processing power and make it easier to consume locally on the edge, as we call it,
edge,
this is a phenomenal opportunity for the experience. So if the experience is better, then you as a consumer and an enterprise are going to adopt it more. Second is, it's not going to mean that Azure's done. A lot of the processing will go to Azure in the cloud. The point of this is you're going to have a lot of different ways to effectively handle these requests. And the beauty of what Microsoft's doing versus Amazon versus Google is that Microsoft goes up and down the stack, from applications to hardware to infrastructure security. A lot of the other companies are stuck in the infrastructure world, and they're partnering with application companies. So CIOs, they're making these decisions, are looking at this saying, well, if I've got an AI machine, I've got an office experience in terms of AI. I can put my back end and security and all my data on Microsoft. This kind of one-stop shop really is resonating. And again, Nadella nailed it. He was way ahead of everyone else. He led this whole journey. And this is why, you know, Microsoft, Google's playing catch up. Amazon's playing catch up.
Yeah.
And they are going to catch up. But again, from my perspective on the enterprise side, Microsoft's ahead. The consumer side, it's really Meta and Facebook right now.
Deirdre, quick last word.
/ Meta.
The last word I would say, one thing we didn't talk about is sort of Microsoft's diversifying its AI strategy. New partnership with another AI darling, and that's on top of OpenAI, which it made that $13 billion bet on. Hmm. Is OpenAI's problem starting to reflect on Microsoft? I think Steve Kovac said that Sam Altman will be taking the stage, but it's notable, too, that they've had Mustafa Suleiman, who came from Inflection and was a big hire for them. And they're putting more people out front and center, and more partnerships, and maybe you're seeing a diversification.
That's a great point. I see Brent nodding as well. All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you both for your time today. Really appreciate it. Deirdre Bosa, Brent Thill from Jefferies. Coming up, CNBC's parent company Comcast revealing its latest streaming bundle. Oh, yes, the bundle is back. We'll look at what's in it, how much it costs, and who could come out on top in the race to rebundle. Plus, three more names on deck to report, including this one. And our trader is a buyer, calling it a cheap stock with a lot of upside potential. Can you guess it? It's coming up in Earnings Exchange.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your CNBC News update at this hour. Former New York City mayor and Donald Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani pleaded not guilty today to 9 felony charges in Arizona's election interference case. Giuliani and at least 11 others are expected to be arraigned today on conspiracy, forgery, fraud charges for allegedly trying to subvert Joe Biden's 2020 election victory in that state. More than 25 million people across the Midwest are under the threat of powerful storms, bringing severe thunderstorms, destructive hail, and strong tornadoes. Rounds of severe storms have been making their way across the U.S. over the past week, including one that hit Houston, leaving hundreds of thousands of residents there without power amid high heat and humidity. And the French railway workers went on strike today to obtain an Olympic bonus for the extra work for agents mobilized during the Paris 2024 games in a couple of months. Other French unions, including those representing garbage collectors, or Le Garbage, police and airport workers have also demanded Olympic bonuses. Le bonus. Back to you, Kelly.
Le Garbage. Tyler, Le Garbage. Thank you very much, Tyler Matheson. Coming up, gold is surging to new records. The commodity has settled at a new record 23 times already this year. So, do you stick with it, or is the rally about to lose its shine? We have a classic bull bear debate on that coming your way right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. Gold prices keep hitting new highs, but Verdad's Dan Rasmussen thinks a correction could be coming, saying, quote, with today's real gold price at the high end of historical distribution, this research suggests gold could see a meaningful downward revision in prices over the next 10 years. Let's debate that. Gabelli Gold Fund's Associate Portfolio Manager Chris Mancini is our gold bull today. And Bob Parker, Senior Advisor at the International Capital Markets Association, is our gold bear. I bet it was harder to find a bear than a bull, actually, for this discussion. Welcome to you both. Chris, make your case. Why should people still pick it up here when we're talking about 27 new highs already this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the big picture is that the gold price is still here, notwithstanding big withdrawals and redemptions from gold-backed ETFs. So in the United States, we've seen consistent selling of gold-backed ETFs. Gold-backed ETFs like the GLD are typically the swing supply or demand of gold in the market, because there's typically a baseload of demand from Chinese and Indian consumers, a baseload of supply from the mines. So the ETFs make up that swing supply or demand. And we've seen a big supply of gold come on the market from these ETFs. And, you know, notwithstanding that, there's been this big move up. So I think that if and when we do see Westerners become interested in gold, which I think that they will, we'll have another leg up in the price.
Bob, we know they're getting interested because Costco is selling little gold bars, and people, they look at inflation and they think, well, maybe I should own some of this. Peter Bookvar also made some good points to me in the break about how Chinese central banks, global central banks, have been very interested in buying gold this year, and that gold has essentially outperformed the S&P since the turn of the century.
That's correct. However, if we sort of look more recently, gold has clearly underperformed a number of other commodities, most notably copper and silver. And just in the last month, gold has obviously underperformed the S&P. And, you know, if we look at what's happening in gold markets at the moment, China is absolutely key. It's not just the Central Bank of China that has increased its asset allocation to gold. We've seen Chinese retail investors, strong demand from that source for gold purchases, partly because they have fears about the Chinese economy. And also there are these rumors, which obviously the central bank are dismissing, that China may consider a devaluation of the Chinese renminbi. And that is obviously causing some fear amongst Chinese investors. I think another factor, obviously, is that with sanctions, Russia, which is the second largest producer of gold worldwide, its marketing of gold onto global markets is obviously disrupted because of those sanctions. Now, if we look forward, clearly one big problem for gold, apart from the fact that it's technically overbought, the price is obviously very high relative to where we've been in the last couple of months. But we are now in a monetary regime of positive real rates. As a result, I think that is really going to cap the upside. Hmm. I think other factors that if we look at what is supporting gold, a number of the factors could prove temporary. So, you know, I do think that not necessarily thinking very long term, but just over the coming months, gold is vulnerable to a setback.
It has been interesting to see it rally so sharply in the face of these persistently high real rates. Chris, not to get too in the weeds about it, but where do you think gold could be headed? The 1980s adjusted kind of high would be around the 3,200 per ounce mark. We're still about $1,000 below that. Are you seeing a breakout of that nature coming?
I think that's definitely in the cards. I mean, you know, when we look at what's happened with Bitcoin, for example, when that goes from 55,000 to 67,000, you know, a move right now from 2,400 up to 3,200, you know, I would just say, why not? And again, you know, the really interesting factor here is that we're not seeing any real interest from American buyers. I mean, aside from, you know, we're seeing Costco, we're seeing the retail thing, but in terms of like American institutions buying the gold-backed ETFs, it's just not there. And so if we ever do see that little tailwind, for sure, I could see it going to $3,000 an ounce.
All right, Bob, quick last word. Why not? Why are you not in that camp?
First of all, I think we're probably going to see a pause in Chinese buying, and you know what's happened in Chinese monetary and fiscal policy in the last couple of weeks, I think, will temper that Chinese buying. I also think the Chinese central bank probably will pause after quite strong increase in its gold asset allocation. And the key, as Chris quite rightly says, is what do American and European investors do? And I think they're focused much more on what's happening in global equity markets and global fixed income markets. And for European and American investors, I think gold is very much on the sidelines, at least for the moment.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciated that. Chris Mancini, Bob Parker, as gold reaches yet more new highs. Coming up, Comcast is getting the bundle back together. The telecom giant revealing its tri-platform package. We'll explain what that means, have the details, and of course, how much it'll cost next. Welcome back to The Exchange. CNBC's parent company, Comcast, just unveiled new details of its streaming bundle. Julia Boorstin has the story for us. Julia?
Kelly, Comcast's Stream Saver bundle is launching next week. Comcast cable CEO Dave Watson just this morning sharing some details. Now, this bundle of Peacock Premium, Netflix Standard with ads, and Apple TV Plus will be available for Comcast Xfinity Internet and TV customers for $15 a month. That's a discount of about 30% or nearly $100 a year. Now, subscribers to Comcast Broadband and its Now TV Skinny streaming bundle, which costs $20 a month for 40 streaming channels, can add on the Stream Saver bundle for an additional $10, bringing that price tag up to $30 a month. Now, Watson's saying that this Stream Saver bundle is designed to drive value for broadband customers to reduce churn. And he also said that it opens the possibility for other potential bundles down the line. All of this comes ahead of the bundle of Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max, which is set to launch this summer. We have no details on timing or pricing just yet. And then there's the streaming sports joint venture between Fox, Warner Brothers, Discovery's TNT, and Disney's ESPN. This is set to launch by the fall. Now, on Friday, we learned its name, Venue Sports, and the fact that it'll combine linear and digital feeds from all three of those broadcasters. Sources tell us it will be in the $40 to $50 range. Now, all of these bundles are trying to reduce churn, to increase engagement, which is incredibly valuable for ad revenue, and also to use their combined heft to help reduce marketing costs. Now I'm speculating about what's going to happen with Paramount Plus, with its parent company facing some big questions. Now we're watching to see which apps Paramount Plus could bundle with to help address its lack of scale. Kelly?
Venue Sports. I don't know. They say people, Verizon took some getting used to. Maybe Venue Sports will roll off the tongue. I guess, Julia, the larger question is, with an already confused consumer, will this help or hinder? I mean, I guess you'd have to think about Netflix being an easy one. But all of these properties, Peacock is one that kind of includes linear channels, obviously, because it's a Comcast product. It's hard to think about, you know, what is the content that I'm trying to watch, the streaming or linear service that might offer it, and then the bundle that might be the best economic way of putting this all back together. And it keeps changing.
It keeps changing, but I think the idea with these bundles is that they're going to be a little bit of a one-stop shop. And if you think about what the Stream Saver bundle has, Peacock has live news and sports. Yes, it has some content too, but Netflix is kind of the everything app. And the fact that they're really pushing the ad-supported version here shows they're trying to drive eyeballs so they can grow their ad revenue. And then Apple TV Plus, that's kind of the premium play, more like what HBO used to be. And so if you subscribe to all of these together, the hope is you'll get everything you need and you won't be churning in or out at the end of the month because you just finished your favorite show.
Very interesting. All right, the next iteration, the bundle. Julia, thanks very much. We appreciate it, Julia Boorstin. Coming up, buy the sizzle, sell the steak. That's how our next guest is trading this name into the print. It's nearly doubled over the past year and is just below its 52-week high. We've got that name and two others about to report in today's earnings exchange. That's next.
Welcome back. We're getting a read on consumer purchases, big and small, in today's earnings exchange. We've got Toll Brothers, Urban, and TJX all reporting ahead. And here with our trades is Quint Tatro, Jewel Financial's founder and president. Quint, it's great to see you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Kelly. It's good to be here.
Cinco. All right, let's start off with Toll Brothers. That was the mystery chart from earlier. The home builders nearly doubled over the past year, despite the, or maybe because of those higher mortgage rates and an uncertain demand picture. Quint, big, a lot of questions. Some people think this could be on a multi-year run still. I don't know. Are you a buyer here?
We're not a buyer here, Kelly. This is a great example of how markets work. I mean, you're dealing with mortgage applications that are at 20-year lows, housing starts that have been poor for many years with the interest rate environment, yet Toll and many of the home building stocks have just been on a tear. And our belief is that, again, you let it off. You buy the sizzle, sell the steak. This is a name that has been pricing in the anticipation of rates coming down and an uptick in, you know, mortgages, home buying, et cetera. So again, getting ahead of this here, buying it now, I think you're setting yourself up for some pretty big disappointment. I mean, at this moment, this stock is now trading 10 times forward earnings, which might look cheap, except the projections are for flat to negative earnings growth over the next 5 years. So again, this is a name that we suspect once everybody sees what has been anticipated, which is lower rates. This is a name you do not want to be in.
It's funny because if you liked it, you know, here at valuation, you would have loved it at three times or wherever we were a couple of years ago. All right, let's move along then. A more traditional retail, Urban Outfitters or Urban Outfitters parent company, Urban Outfitters, you know, Anthro, Urban, all of it. They're up 16% this year as a sales slowdown in Urban Outfitters is offset by growth at Free People and Anthro. Quint, how do you feel about Urban?
Yeah, this is a name we actually do like and we think could surprise to the upside. This is a name also trading around 10 times forward, but has that growth for a retailer. It's decent, coming in at about 10% in anticipation. Pretty decent balance sheet for a retailer. We like that. But here's one thing that I thought was fascinating. If you go back to 2010 fiscal year, Urban earned about $1.50. They're set to earn about $3 in the trailing 12 for this company. So they have doubled earnings in that time, and the stock has gone nowhere. It's peaked out around 35 to 40, going back for the last 20 years. So this has been really compounding internally, growing that book value, and it just not has been have been given the higher multiple that we think it deserves here.
That's super interesting. We don't often find cases like that, so I'm glad you highlighted. All right, let's move along to TJX then, which of course owns TJ Maxx and Marshalls and Home Goods, up about 4% this year. It's trailing the market, even though it's the off-price destination. Of course, it's been such a strong stock for such a long time. Consumer may be more cost-conscious right now. What do you do with this one?
Yeah, you keep going to the store, but you don't own the stock, Kelly. We've talked about names like this before in the past with teenage boys, right? Kroger and Milk and so forth. But TJ Maxx is up there for us. We like the store. Great value, but just not a name that I want to be in. It's been an amazing run, but now it's trading 21 times forward earnings, only set to grow those earnings at about 10 to 11%. And it has a very levered up balance sheet. Now, here's the kicker. Into the report, it could get some, you know, some bump regarding the lower end and the consumer and seeing an uptick in sales. I think if you're in this, you take any strength and you book those profits here.
Very interesting. Almost the opposite story of Urban. So they make kind of a nice pair to compare that way. The financials and then the valuation and how the stock's done. We'll see if they shift tides here after they all report. Quint, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kelly.
Quint Tatro, Jewel Financial. That's it for The Exchange. Coming up next on Power Lunch, oh yes, we're speaking with PGA Championship winner Xander Schauffele on his victory. And what's next? Tyler's getting ready. I'll join him on the other side of this break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.